Welcome to the March Dermatologic Surgery Digest podcast. I am the podcast editor, Naomi Lawrence. In this month's journal, there is a retrospective chart review on topical treatment of cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma in situ with 5-fluorouracil, which helps identify those in situ lesions that might best respond for at least 2 years. I hope the authors plan a 5-year evaluation, as this gives a practical, low-cost alternative to surgery. There is also a review of the debulked specimens for melanoma undergoing Mohs surgery that shows a much lower rate of upstaging than previously described in the literature. Thank you for listening, and have a happy surgery day.
This segment of the episode features surgical oncology and reconstructive article reviews.
This is Erica Levitt reviewing the original article, Topical Treatment of Cutaneous Squamous Cell Carcinoma in Situ and the Impact of Clinical Risk Factors and Positive Histologic Margins at the Time of Diagnosis, by authors Brandon Cowley and Melanie Clark. For background, topical 5-fluorouracil or 5-FU and imiquimod are FDA-approved for superficial basal cell carcinoma, but are often used off-label for squamous cell carcinoma in situ or SCCIS. A systematic review from 2009 reported SCCIS clearance rates of 73-83% for 5-FU and 27-85% for imiquimod. This current study is a retrospective review evaluating the efficacy of these topical therapies at preventing recurrence of SCCIS, and to specifically look at the impact of positive histologic margins on biopsy prior to treatment. The inclusion criteria for the study was patients with SCCIS that had positive histologic margins on the diagnostic biopsy and were then treated with either topical 5-FU or imiquimod. The primary endpoint was recurrence with a 2-year follow-up period that was defined either pathologically or through high clinical suspicion. There were 210 patients treated with 5-FU and only 5 patients treated with imiquimod in the study. The overall recurrence rate was 9%, and recurrence was more likely in patients with larger diameter lesions prior to biopsy. There was no significant difference in recurrence based on the presence of follicular extension on biopsy. Out of the 5 patients treated with imiquimod, 3 had recurrence for a 60% recurrence rate, compared to the 8% recurrence rate for patients with 5-FU. The very small sample size for the imiquimod group significantly limits the generalizability of these imiquimod results. Overall, the results do suggest that 5-FU could be an effective treatment for SCCIS with a recurrence rate of only 8% in their cohort. This study is different from prior studies by limiting the analysis to only tumors that had positive histologic biopsy margins, suggesting that this pathology pattern should not preclude the use of topical 5-FU. The recurrence rate in their study did increase for tumors greater than 1 centimeter, which is something to keep in mind. One limitation is that some of the recurrences were diagnosed only clinically, but that would likely, if anything, overestimate the recurrence rate, as some precursor lesions such as actinic keratoses may have been incorrectly marked as a clinical recurrence. I was also particularly interested that follicular extension on biopsy was not a significant predictor of recurrence, suggesting that 5-FU can be considered for these lesions as well.
This is Deirdre Connolly reviewing the original investigation, Pathologic Upstaging of Cutaneous Melanoma After Mohs Micrographic Surgery, senior author Nima Garavi. Mohs surgery is used for melanoma in situ and thin invasive melanomas, particularly on the head and neck, during which a debulk section is typically prepared. Tumor upstaging occurs if the debulking specimen meets criteria for an increased T stage per the AJCC 8th edition compared with the initial biopsy. Upstaging can result in significant therapeutic ramifications, such as evaluation by other oncologic and surgical subspecialties, and the possible need for sentinel lymph node biopsy, imaging, or further surgical intervention. Altered survival and recurrence outcomes can also result in increased patient morbidity and mortality. The authors aim to determine the rate of cutaneous melanoma upstaging during Mohs. By way of a multicenter study, from three dermatologic surgeons performing Mohs from 2017 to 2021. 310 cases of cutaneous melanoma treated with Mohs were identified. 80% of the treated tumors were melanoma in situ. 2.3% of cases were upstaged, ranging from T1A to T3A. There was a slight predominance of upstaging cases in men on the scalp. In all cases, upstaging was because of an increase in Breslow depth and not because of ulceration. There were no identified demographic or tumor-specific factors that were significantly linked to an increased rate of cutaneous melanoma upstaging. Previous studies report upstaging rate of melanoma in situ during surgical treatment as 4 to 8%, with 1 to 2% of upstage melanoma in situ treated with Mohs requiring sentinel lymph node biopsy. Overall, authors' data demonstrate a lower rate of cutaneous melanoma upstaging during Mohs than the current literature reports. Differences may be accounted for because of different patient populations, cutaneous melanoma detection at an earlier clinical stage, and evolving melanoma histologic criteria.
This is Christy Regula reviewing the original article, Pure and Mixed Variants of Desmoplastic Melanoma, a single-center retrospective clinicopathologic review by first author Jeremy Light and senior author Basia Milchowski. Desmoplastic melanoma is a rare variant of spindle cell melanoma, accounting for 1 to 4% of all melanoma skin cancer. Histologically, desmoplastic melanoma is characterized by fusiform melanocytes with an abundant collagenous stroma. Two types of desmoplastic melanoma have been defined: pure desmoplastic melanoma and mixed desmoplastic melanoma. Pure desmoplastic melanoma is defined as a tumor that contains greater than 90% stromal fibrosis with a posicellular distribution of spindle-shaped melanocytes, while a mixed desmoplastic melanoma is defined as a tumor that contains greater than 10% densely cellular non-fibrotic areas. The estimated survival for desmoplastic melanoma is less than that of conventional melanoma, ranging between 67 to 89%. It has also been found to have a particularly high mutation burden, with NF1 and TP53 mutations being frequently implicated. Due to such potential differences in biologic behavior and outcomes, the utility of current treatment guidelines for conventional melanoma are often questioned in cases of desmoplastic melanoma, as evidence-based treatment recommendations are lacking for this rare subtype. This is further complicated by the histopathologic distinction described between pure and mixed desmoplastic melanoma. This retrospective analysis of desmoplastic melanoma cases aimed to compare the clinical pathologic characteristics of pure and mixed desmoplastic melanoma. The study was performed at WashU and identified all cases of desmoplastic melanoma during a 22-year time period. Demographic, clinical, and histopathologic information was collected. 52 patients in total were identified. 26 were pure desmoplastic melanoma, and 26 were mixed desmoplastic melanoma. There were no statistically significant differences in demographics or tumor location between the two subtypes. Patients with mixed desmoplastic melanoma were more likely to have mitoses present. There were no differences in Breslow's depth, tumor diameter, level of invasion, ulceration, and lymphovascular or perineural invasion. The utilization of sentinel lymph node biopsy was similar, with about 61.5% of patients with pure desmoplastic melanoma undergoing sentinel lymph node biopsy and 50% of patients with mixed desmoplastic melanoma. There was no significant difference in sentinel lymph node positivity, with an overall positivity of 10%. Overall, this study found that despite histopathologic distinction between pure and mixed desmoplastic melanoma, these subtypes were found to have similar clinical pathologic characteristics.
This is Ashley Decker reviewing the original article, Histopathologic Characterization of Incidental Lesions Encountered During Mohs Micrographic Surgery with MART1 Immunohistochemistry by senior author Dr. Hirotsu and senior author Dr. Asai. Melanoma antigen-recognized T cells, or MART1, is the most common IHC used in Mohs for melanoma. Despite its high specificity, sensitivity, and utility in highlighting the key features of melanoma in situ, it can also stain both incidental benign and neoplastic lesions that are within the margin. And it is important for Mohs surgeons to be able to differentiate these lesions from the melanoma. In this original investigation, a comprehensive review of frozen section generated slides from Mohs cases utilizing MART1 IHC with brown chromogen and H&E over a two-year period were evaluated, and the histologic findings of benign and malignant lesions were categorized. For the purpose of this review, I will highlight the main defining histological features of the incidental lesions discussed. However, the authors provide a very comprehensive overview of the histological findings of these lesions in Table 1, and I invite listeners to review the table. The incidental finding of a solar lentigo is extremely common. On H&E, there are thin, elongated, club-shaped epidermal projections along reedy ridges. Pigment often accumulates at the end of these projections. MART1 frequently highlights this pigment, and it is important to differentiate pseudonesting from true nested melanocytes, which are accompanied by additional features of melanoma, such as pagetoid spread. Solar lentigines have a normal density melanocytes with increased keratinocyte pigmentation. Pigmented keratinocytes are differentiated from melanocytes by the presence of intercellular desmosomes and a perinuclear halo artifact, whereas melanocytes demonstrate pale blue-gray cytoplasm and pericytoplasmic halo artifact. Seborrheic keratoses are another common incidental finding. SKs have a normal number of melanocytes and may have pigmented keratinocytes at the base, which is visible both on H&E and MART1. Benign nevi are also frequently encountered, as up to a third of melanomas arise from benign nevi. Benign nevi are well circumscribed and symmetric with maturation of melanocytes. There is an absence of granzome and overlying melanoma in situ. Melanotic macules have mild acanthosis, broad reedy ridges, uniform basilar pigmentation, and melanophages are present in the dermis. There is a normal density of melanocytes with keratinocyte pigmentation. Lichenoid keratoses are solar lentigines or solar lentigos undergoing lymphocyte-mediated regression. MART1 can highlight pseudomelanocytic nests in all lichenoid reactions, including lichenoid keratoses, which can mimic melanoma in situ, but other features of MIS, including pagetoid spread, confluence of melanocytes along the DEJ, and cytosolic atypia are not seen. Actinic keratoses are also a common incidental finding, and pigmented AKs can have increased keratinocyte pigmentation highlighted by MART1, but they will have normal melanocyte density and sparse pagetoid spread. Sparse pagetoid scatter of melanocytes has been reported in squamous cell carcinoma in situ, and H&E correlation is important to identify features of SCCIS. Benign reactive melanocytes highlighted by MART1 may be distributed deeper in the dermis. Pigmented basal cells can exhibit focal deposits of melanin throughout the tumor on H&E. Pigmented basal cells can have an increased melanocyte count compared to non-pigmented basal cells in sun-exposed and intermittently sun-exposed skin, so H&E correlation is very helpful. MART1 can be difficult to interpret in patients who have extensive background actinic damage due to the increased density of melanin in basal keratinocytes, especially when using brown chromogen. Some of this can be mitigated by using either red, green, or blue chromogen instead, however, it is more expensive. When differentiating sun-damaged skin from MIS, look for other key features of MIS as well. Benign reactive dermal melanocytes can also be a pitfall. These are singly dispersed, bland, spindle to rounded MART1 positive dermal cells. They can be differentiated from invasive melanoma by their small size, lack of cytologic atypia, present granzone, absence of overlying MIS, and lack of nesting. I think the authors really did a great job giving a succinct histologic review of common lesions incidentally found during Mohs surgery, specifically for melanoma. It is important that histologic differences are identified so that additional unnecessary levels are not taken. As someone who does Mohs for melanoma, there are cases in areas of extensive sun damage where it really can be challenging to determine if it is true MIS versus reactive, and considering use of other colored chromogens in these cases may be beneficial.
This is Deirdre Connolly reviewing the original investigation, Nasal Lining Repair, a Comprehensive Literature Review, senior author Rajiv Najawan. The authors compiled this communication as a guide on how to approach reconstruction of nasal lining in full-thickness nasal defects resulting from Mohs. They synthesized literature from dermatologic surgery, plastic surgery, and otolaryngology to review repair options, though there are neither prospective nor retrospective studies on the topic. Given the lack of data on this topic, largely anecdotal case reports and series were available. First, authors discuss secondary intention healing of the nasal lining. Healing here is aided by the nasal mucosa's rich anastomotic network via the ethmoidal arteries, superior labial artery, and greater palatine artery. Some surgeons choose not to address the nasal lining aspect of the defect and just repair the cutaneous aspect, expecting the nasal lining to granulate. A general rule is that secondary intention healing is reasonable if the defect does not affect the nasal valve or lead to alar notching. Another option is primary closure of nasal lining defects, which should be reserved for small, linear, and vertically oriented defects. Defects located on the nasal dome or sidewall measuring 5 millimeters or less are ideal for such closures. The main limitation of primary closure is potential distortion of the nasal tip, notching, distortion of the nasal valve, and distorting the relationship between the ala and the columella. In cases where nasal scaffolding is less of a concern, a full-thickness skin graft can be another option with donor sites from several locations. Small sidewall defects may be most appropriate for full-thickness skin grafts because they do not interfere with nasal valve integrity. Grafts secured to the undersurface of the paramedian forehead flap are a reliable option for restoring the lining, with the option to insert cartilage in one of the reconstructive stages for additional structural support. Nasal packing or quilting sutures can help with graft survival. For larger defects of the nasal lining, hinge flaps can be considered. The cutaneous aspect of the nasal sidewall or hairless medial cheek along the nasolabial fold are excellent reservoirs used in a turn-in or flip-over fashion, useful for deep defects of the dorsum, sidewall, and the ala. It's beneficial to ensure that the flap's vertical height is slightly greater than the vertical height of the mucosal defect to account for wound contracture. The nasal septum, both on the ipsilateral and contralateral sides, is highly vascular and can be used to reconstruct the nasal lining as well. In instances where a single-stage flap is preferable, a single-stage melolabial foldover flap can be considered. This approach is best for defects less than 1 to 1.5 centimeters wide that involve the alar rim. The proximal or distal portion of the flap may be used as the internal nasal lining, depending on the position relative to the alar base, and as per the surgeon's preferences. Care should be taken not to harvest an overly thick flap to avoid bulkiness of the ala, while also ensuring to appropriately thin the flap as needed to match the contralateral ala. Two-stage melolabial interpolation flaps can be used to repair defects that include the alar rim. This repair is often considered for full-thickness defects equal or larger than 1 centimeter involving the lower third of the nose. This flap can be folded over in a similar fashion to the single-stage fold-over flaps for full-thickness alar defects. Finally, the paramedian forehead flap is a versatile option for full-thickness nasal defects requiring lining repair. For superior defects that don't involve the rim or the nasal tip, the paramedian forehead flap can be used as a wound bed for a full-thickness skin graft. For distal full-thickness defects, a fold-over technique can be used in which the distal flap is used for the nasal lining, the intermediate aspect recreates the alar rim, and the inferior or proximal aspect of the flap becomes the cutaneous aspect of the distal nose. Cartilage support grafts may be placed within the flap if necessary for structural support.
This is Michael Renzi reviewing the original investigation patient satisfaction following primary closure or second intention healing after conventional nasal skin cancer excision, a cross-sectional cohort study by first author Frederick Thielen and senior author Martin Hoge-Bergen. Nearly 30% of the defects after non-melanoma skin cancer resection are located in the nasal area. Because the nose has a complex three-dimensional structure with limited skin laxity, nasal defects can distort the facial identity and aesthetic appearance. Patient satisfaction after surgery and its impact on the quality of life are some of the most crucial indicators of success, but are highly subjective. Therefore, the authors of this study sought to evaluate patient satisfaction after nasal skin cancer reconstruction with primary closure or second intention healing using the FACE-Q skin cancer scale. All resections were performed by one of five plastic surgeons at the institution via conventional surgical excision, choice of reconstruction method via either primary closure or second intention healing was arbitrarily selected by the surgeon performing the procedure. Low-grade basal cell carcinomas, nodular and superficial, were excised with 3 to 4 millimeter margins, whereas squamous cell carcinomas, Bowen disease, and high-grade BCCs, being infiltrative or micronodular subtypes, were excised with a 5 millimeter margin. The histological tumor information followed 5 to 7 days after excision. If histological free margins could not be met, a re-excision was performed. If more than 2 re-excisions were necessary, the patient was referred to a medical center that performed Mohs surgery, and the subject was excluded from the study. All included patients were asked to complete 3 scales and 1 checklist of the FACE-Q skin cancer module translated to Dutch. Patients were contacted at 9 months or later after reconstruction and were asked to complete the questionnaires by email or answer directly over the phone. Patients with greater than 1 nasal defect reconstructed with either primary closure or second intention healing were asked to fill in the questionnaire separately for each scar. Each scale consists of 8 to 10 questions, with each question containing 4 response options. The responses are rated on a Likert-type scale, summed and then converted to a Roche score ranging from 0 to 100. Higher scores represented greater satisfaction with facial appearance, greater satisfaction with the scar, and increased distress, respectively. A total of 183 patients with 186 nasal defects were included. A re-excision was performed in 18 nasal defects. If the patient had a re-excision, the final reconstruction method was used for the analysis. Of the 186 defects, 76 were closed by primary closure and 110 by second intention healing. The mean final surgical defect diameter was 14.1 millimeters for primary closure and 13.4 millimeters for second intention healing. There was a significant difference between reconstruction type and the location of the defect, with most common location for primary closure being the nasal dorsum at 38.2% and for second intention healing the alar region at 40%. Of the 183 patients, 140 patients completed the questionnaire. Of these, 55 defects were closed by primary closure and 88 healed by second intention. Both groups reported high overall facial satisfaction at 88.5 for primary closure and 91.8 for second intention healing. This difference was not significant. The final multivariable model for the satisfaction with facial appearance scale, adjusting for age, sex, localization of the nasal defect, previous oncologic facial surgery, and the occurrence of a complication, showed no significant association between the reconstruction method and facial appearance score. Higher age and the absence of a complication and no previous facial surgery led to significantly higher facial appearance scores. A trend for lower facial appearance scores was seen for women, scoring 5 points lower than men. The mean scar satisfaction scores were 92.1 for primary closure and 92.8 for second intention healing. This was also not a significant difference. The final multivariate scar appraisal model showed no significant difference for scar appraisal between second intention healing and primary closure. Appearance-related distress scores were low in both groups, and there was no significant difference at 20.4 for primary closure and 19.2 for second intention. I think the takeaway from the study is the confirmation that patients are typically satisfied with primary closure for small defects on the nasal dorsum and for second intention healing for small defects on the nasal ala. This study is limited by the fact that closure method was not randomized, and I think this would have allowed for greater ability to assess satisfaction with second intention scars on the nasal dorsum, which would be a potentially useful result.
This is Erica Levitt reviewing the original article, Complications Associated with Split-Thickness Skin Grafts Harvested from the Hair-Bearing Scalp, by authors Maria Bovenberg and Leonard Goldberg. For brief background, split-thickness skin grafts consist of epidermis and only a portion of the dermis, and common harvest sites include the thigh, arm, or abdomen. This was a prospective observational study of 15 patients who had Mohs surgery on the ear and had a split-thickness skin graft harvested from the hair-bearing scalp. The authors hypothesized that the hair-bearing scalp donor site would result in good scar outcomes, faster re-epithelialization of the donor site, and fewer postoperative complications due to the higher follicular density. The grafts were obtained with a flexible double-edged razor blade. Hairs were then removed with a needle driver prior to the graft being trimmed and sutured to the defect. The patients in their cohort did very well. Pain was highest on the first night after surgery at 1.8 on a scale to 6, but declined significantly by postoperative day 2 and was gone by 1 week. 80% of the donor sites were completely healed by only 1 week follow-up. There were no major complications, and all patients had full regrowth of hair at the donor site by 1 month. The mean Vancouver Scar Scale score, as rated by two dermatologists at 1 month for the Mohs site, was 0.26, consistent with an excellent scar outcome. This small study does suggest that the hair-bearing scalp may be an excellent donor site for split-thickness skin grafts on the ear and can be easy to harvest with rapid healing at the donor site. In the future, larger studies comparing this technique with other graft donor sites or reconstruction techniques would be helpful. I may try this technique in my own practice.
This is Michael Renzi reviewing the reconstructive conundrum, repair of a total scrotal defect extending into the perianal area, by first author Caroline Wolkowski and senior author Jeremy Bordeaux. The authors present the repair of a full thickness defect involving the entire scrotum and extending into the perianal region and the right inguinal fold following Mohs for extramammary Paget's disease. Two full-thickness skin grafts were performed to achieve the maximal maintenance of the spherical contour of the scrotum and to provide support for the scrotal content. Secondary intention healing was selected for the right inguinal fold and perineum. Potential donor sites were evaluated for texture, color, and thickness to achieve the best match. The bilateral upper inner arms were chosen as the donor sites with one full thickness skin graft taken from each arm. Special care was taken with the two grafts to match the spherical contour of the scrotum. A hammock shape was created with the grafts by wrapping them from the base around the scrotal contents, which aided in preventing separation from the wound base. The authors achieved a great outcome here at 6 months, and it can be seen in figure 3 of the article.
This is Deirdre Connolly reviewing the reconstructive conundrum, repair of a lateral eyebrow defect, first author Michael Visconti, senior author Eileen Axibal. A 64-year-old woman underwent Mohs for a basal cell carcinoma that cleared in 3 stages with the defect extending deep to the orbicularis oculi muscle, measuring 1.7 by 2.6 centimeters. This resulted in the loss of a significant portion of the lateral eyebrow. The authors considered that, generally speaking, lateral to medial tissue movement is preferred in eyebrow reconstruction because the medial portion of the brow is paramount in central facial symmetry and cosmesis. For this patient with a moderately sized, full-thickness, horizontally oriented lateral eyebrow defect, authors performed a Banner transposition flap that used a superolateral tissue reservoir incorporating the temporal hairline to repair the defect and restore the eyebrow. A Banner transposition flap was designed so that the distal portion of the flap included the intermediate hair from the temporal hairline, and the more proximal portion was devoid of hair. The flap was elevated in the deep subcutaneous plane to preserve neurovascular supply and prevent compromise of the hair follicle units. The flap was then transposed in a clockwise direction into the primary defect of the lateral brow. Of note, the repair did result in a color mismatch and slight decrease in the density and increase in the length and height of the tail of the brow. However, the patient was happy with her overall result.
This is Ashley Decker reviewing the communication, Respecting the Art of Medicine, Wide Local Excision of Melanoma Within a Tattoo Sleeve, by Dr. Housewright. Tattoos are very common and are viewed as a personal artistic expression. However, there are tattoo-associated skin conditions, including cutaneous malignancies occurring within the tattoo or in its adjacent skin. Surgical treatment may impact the tattoo, and it can lead to a discussion about maintaining the tattoo's integrity while also adhering to treatment guidelines. The authors present a case of a 37-year-old female with a melanoma in situ arising within a tattoo on the right radial forearm. The patient was emotionally attached to her tattoo and wanted to preserve the integrity of the tattoo despite the need for surgical excision. The author designed a wide local excision in a way to minimize significant stylistic changes to the tattoo and took efforts to carefully align and approximate the tattoo during closure. Not only can there be an emotional attachment to tattoos, there also is a financial component as tattoos range in price based on size and intricacy. It can be challenging to remove a skin cancer located in or near a tattoo while both following appropriate guidelines in terms of margins, but also ensuring the integrity of the tattoo as much as possible. Based on the type of skin cancer and location, non-surgical treatment options may be considered, but this can also affect the appearance of the tattoo as well. Tattoos can cause adverse effects on the skin, and although there are no clear established roles between tattoos and skin cancers, there are many case reports in the literature of cutaneous malignancies arising within tattoos. In the U.S., regulation around composition of tattoo ink is fairly loose and can potentially contain carcinogenic substances such as polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, 2-naphthalene, and others. Multiple mechanisms of carcinogenesis involving tattoo ink have been proposed. This may be complicated further by migration of melanophagins containing tattoo pigment migrating to regional lymph nodes, leading to lymphatic accumulation of these toxins. It's also harder to surveil the skin within the area of the tattoo as the pigment can obscure the clinical findings, leading to a later diagnosis. Tattoo ink can also obscure histologic margin evaluation. Personally, I have treated several patients with cutaneous malignancies within or adjacent to their tattoos. Most of my patients to this point have been more concerned with adequate removal of the malignancy rather than maintaining the artistic integrity of the tattoo. However, I do think it is something to be important or to be mindful of, especially if the patient does have an emotional attachment to the tattoo.
This is Christy Regula reviewing the communication Mohs Micrographic Surgery for Congenital Scalp Dermatofibrosarcoma Protuberans with Novel PLEKHH2 ALK Gene Fusion by first author Rachel Ward and senior author Allison Vidimos. This is the case of a 9-month-old girl who was referred for a biopsy-proven spindle cell neoplasm on the left frontal scalp. The birth history was complicated by attempted vaginal delivery with forceps assistance, which was converted to an emergency section. The patient's growth and development history were otherwise unremarkable. The lesion was present at birth, and the family attributed it to trauma from the use of the forceps. But over the following 6 months, the lesion tripled in size. Examination showed a 2 by 1.6 centimeter salmon-colored plaque with overlying podocarpal texture. A punch biopsy showed an infiltrative spindle cell neoplasm composed of monomorphic spindle cells arranged in a vaguely storiform pattern. Lesional cells were diffusely positive for CD34 and negative for desmin, smooth muscle actin, SOX10, S100, myogenin, and EMA. FISH was performed and no rearrangement of the platelet-derived growth factor beta gene region was identified. Next-generation sequencing demonstrated PLEKHH2 ALK gene fusion. Due to these findings, the tumor was interpreted as a DFSP with a novel gene fusion. An MRI was performed, which showed a 2-centimeter left frontal scalp region with enhancement of the frontal bone and dura suggestive of transosseous extension. A CT showed a 1-millimeter nodule in the left lower lobe and prominence of axillary lymph nodes. Resection of the tumor was performed under general anesthesia with a pediatric plastic surgeon and pediatric neurosurgeon with intraoperative tissue read by a Mohs surgeon. The lesion was cleared in 2 stages, necessitating a 2.5 section of periosteum be removed. A thin layer of outer cortex was also removed by the neurosurgeon and was negative for tumor. The postoperative course was unremarkable. A germline pediatric solid tumor and sarcoma panel was negative for hereditary cancer syndrome. Repeat CT showed stable lung nodule and lymph nodes, which were determined to be inflammatory in nature, and the patient is 25 months post-op without recurrence. Congenital DSFP is an exceptionally rare tumor with about 70 cases reported in the literature. This case highlights a novel PDGF beta negative PLEKHH2 ALK gene fusion positive tumor. ALK fusions are oncogenic and have been reported in other cutaneous neoplasms like anaplastic large cell lymphoma, melanoma, epithelioid fibrous histiocytoma, Merkel cell carcinoma, basal cell, and Spitz tumors, but not previously reported in DSFP. This case also highlights the importance of imaging in preoperative surgical planning. Initial imaging suggested transosseous extension through the frontal bone with dural involvement, but this was actually intact and negative for tumor. It is possible that these MRI findings may represent reactive dural thickening and reactive enhancing fibrosis change permeating the relatively soft and pliable fetal or neonatal calvarium.
This is Ashley Decker, and I'm reviewing the communication, how we do it, Shark Island pedicle flap for alar crease defects. That was written by our former fellow, Dr. Yessel Kim, and senior author, Dr. Naomi Lawrence. Due to its robust blood supply from the nasal branch of the facial artery, the traditional island pedicle flap and its variations are commonly utilized for nasal defects. One of the variations, the shark island pedicle, is a reliable one-stage repair and has been used for split alar and cheek defects, typically using an inferior laterally base flap. The flap was named as such because the flap resembles a shark with a snout and ventral mouth formed from the Mohs defect. The advancement of the flap, along with the rotational movement of the leading edge or the shark's snout, has been described to form an inverted cone of redundancy that recreates the lateral alar facial sulcus, making it a good option for defects involving the alar crease. It has both myocutaneous and a random subcutaneous blood supply, which help maintain the vascularity of the shark's jaws. In this communication, we describe utilizing a superiorly based island shark island pedicle flap for alar crease defects instead of the traditional inferior laterally based pedicle. It's really important to maintain the vascularity to the snout part of the flap by suturing the shark's jaws closed with epidermal sutures only. Utilization of buried sutures may compromise blood flow. Because the flap does cross the alar crease, there's also a risk of internal nasal valve insufficiency, but this can be mitigated by placement of suspension sutures or of a suspension suture from the mucosal lining to the lateral edge of the defect. While there are many different options for small to moderate deep lesions on the ala, many can blunt the alar crease. The shark island pedicle is a great option to recreate the alar crease, and the superiorly based approach is a wonderful option for alar crease defects that are too medial for the more traditionally inferiorly based flap. In addition, the scar line is contained within the nose and does not extend to the cheek. I invite our listeners to review the photographs in the article to really understand flap movement.
This is Christy Regula reviewing How We Do It, application of surgical adhesive to aid in hemostasis during the use of interpolation flaps, by first author Zachary Krepnoski and senior author Daniel Eisen. We all know that interpolated flaps come with an increased risk of postoperative bleeding. Interventions to mitigate bleeding include diligent cautery, additional suture placement, application of pressure dressings, and wrapping petrolatum gauze around the stock of the pedicle. Each of these techniques, however, may risk compromise of the vascular supply of the flap. The authors instead use surgical adhesive, 2-octyl cyanoacrylate. After inset of the flap, the adhesive is applied to the length and undersurface of the pedicle and along the length of the sutured donor site. The hemostatic nature of the tissue glue provides an easy, reliable, and safe alternative to reduce postoperative bleeding in these situations.
This is Erica Levitt reviewing the communication, Repair of a Superolateral Ear Defect, Mohs Deformity, Using Hyaluronic Acid Filler by authors Jeffrey Lee and Shauna Flanagan. This was a case report of a 63-year-old woman who had Mohs surgery on the upper helix by another physician several months prior that was left to heal by second intention. There was a noticeable contour defect of the helical rim when the patient presented to the authors. This contour defect was filled with 0.2 milliliters of Voluma hyaluronic acid filler and contoured with manual manipulation. The contour of the ear was adequately restored and held up well at an 18-month follow-up. The patient's pain improved as well. This case highlights that filler can be considered for a specific subset of scars with a contour irregularity or depression in patients that are able to pay the fee for such a treatment. Although we know that many of the thicker fillers can last many years, I do wonder if the contour deformity would return after the follow-up of 18 months and the patient may need repeat treatment.
This segment of the episode features general dermatologic surgery and cosmetic article reviews.
My name is Karin Lal, and I will be presenting Ingrown Toenails, a survey among dermatologists on current treatments by Dressler et al. Onychocryptosis is a common condition among young adults and adolescents. There is no consensus on management of this condition amongst dermatologists. Current guidelines recommend chemical and/or surgical matrixectomy for the best outcomes with the least recurrence. However, many of these techniques are not often employed in the dermatologic setting. This group created an online survey with 9 images of different ingrown toenails, 5 acute cases and 4 recurrent cases, and they surveyed a bunch of dermatologists, including dermatosurgeons, how they would manage each of these presentations. 101 people completed the survey. 92 participants commented seeing on average 11 patients with ingrown toenails per quarter. According to responses, up to 30% of cases need surgery, and in more than 40% of cases, the participants themselves performed these surgeries. Please see tables 1 and 2 for the pictures sent to surveyors along with the frequency of various surgical and non-surgical interventions. The most frequently selected non-surgical interventions were advice on nail care, foot baths, wraps, padding, tape, and dressing. These were non-surgical interventions. With regards to surgical interventions, removal of the lateral nail plate followed by chemical partial matrixectomy, soft tissue removal, and gutter splint were selected most frequently. 36.3% of participants recommended referral for treatment. Dermatologic surgeons preferred chemical matrixectomy as their surgical intervention of choice. Presence of diabetes and anticoagulant use did not majorly alter treatment options, but more participants would proceed differently if the patient was pregnant. This survey did not query podiatrists, which are more likely to manage these cases and see more cases per quarter.
This is Megan McLean reviewing the cover story and original investigation, the combined application of bleomycin and triamcinolone for treating refractory keloids by our colleagues out of Iran. In this study, the authors sought to assess the efficacy and safety of a combined injection of bleomycin and triamcinolone for otherwise treatment-resistant keloids. They enrolled 36 patients with keloids that had failed to respond to or recurred after other treatments. The patients were injected with 0.3 milliliters of triamcinolone 40 milligrams per milliliter, 0.3 milliliters of bleomycin diluted to 3 international units per milliliter, and 0.3 milliliters of lidocaine. 0.1 mLs of this mixed solution was then injected at 1 centimeter intervals into the keloids until blanching was observed. The maximum volume of injection did not exceed 3 milliliters, and this protocol was repeated every 4 to 6 weeks until the lesions flattened or for a maximum of 6 sessions. The response to treatment was evaluated using the Japan Scar Scale and a graded system for flattening of the keloids. Of the 36 patients enrolled, 2 patients discontinued treatment because of side effects, and 1 was lost to follow-up. Patients underwent an average of 5.21 treatments. Overall, there was a significant improvement in the Japan Scar Scale, and the majority of patients had an excellent response in terms of flattening of the keloids. No patients had a poor response reported. Representative before and after photos are shown in Figure 1 and have quite impressive results. Of the 26 patients who had an excellent response, only 1 patient had a recurrence at 6-month follow-up. Side effects noted included ulceration in 40%, infection and hyperpigmentation each in 33%, hypopigmentation and telangiectasia each in 15%, and pain after procedure in 36%. The authors note that their response rates are higher than in prior studies of bleomycin alone and have lower side effect rates, possibly due to the more dilute dose of bleomycin used in this study than in prior studies. The study is limited by sample size and a lack of a comparator group. Nonetheless, the study suggests that combination of interlesional bleomycin and triamcinolone may be a promising treatment option for patients with treatment-resistant keloids, albeit possibly with higher side effect profile than with just triamcinolone alone.
This is Monica Bowen, and I'll be reviewing Same But Different, an 18-month cross-sectional study of cosmetic procedures in patients with skin phototype 1 through 3 versus 4 through 6 in Toronto, Canada, by first author Stephen Williams and last author Renee Beach. So this was a cross-sectional study of non-surgical cosmetic services requested and performed over an 18-month period at a single dermatology clinic in Toronto, Canada, which is Canada's most populated city with a large minority population. And the goal was to compare cosmetic services requested by phototypes 1 through 3 versus phototypes 4 through 6. And the hypothesis was that the darker phototypes would seek cosmetic procedures more for pigmentation and to target hirsutism. A total of 973 cosmetic appointments were booked during this 18-month period for 367 patients. So for cohort similarities, both of the lighter and darker phototypes, men represented less than 10% of each cohort, which is consistent throughout other surveys. And then there was a shared popularity of electrodesiccation for benign skin lesions. And though neuromodular usage was popular for both cohorts, though notably more for the lighter skin types. So there were several key differences between two groups. The age of time of first appointment actually was younger for the darker skin types. And for skin, the darker phototypes 4 through 6, the three most popular procedures were microneedling, PRP, and electrodesiccation. And these can be managed used to manage hyperpigmentation and skin discoloration. For the phototypes 1 through 3, the most popular procedures were by far neuromodulator injections of the frontalis and glabella and IPL. And so some of the limitations were there was a single center, and it was during COVID. But this study shows that there are some key differences between the phototypes. As the lighter phototypes 1 through 3 were more commonly received procedures to manage their facial aging with neuromodulators and IPL, while the phototypes 4 through 6, they were actually younger patients, and they were more commonly requested procedures to manage hyperpigmentation, such as PRP and microneedling. So, of course, this is a retrospective analysis. However, it will once again address the differences in skin of color patients and hopefully help tailor to this population.
This is Isabella Jones reviewing clinical and OCT correlation of vascular conditions treated with a novel variable sequenced long pulse 532 and 1064 nanometer laser with cryogen spray cooling by Wong and Geronimus. A novel variable sequence long pulse 532 and 1064 nanometer laser with cryogen spray cooling was recently developed. Prior to this, the authors state that PDL is limited by its depth of penetration and NDYAG lasers by only having contact cooling rather than spray cooling. In this study, the authors aim to assess this laser using both clinical data and optical coherence tomography. They enrolled 30 subjects with skin types 1 through 4 needing treatment for telangiectasias, rosacea, port wine stains, and spider angiomas. Subjects were allowed to receive up to 9 treatments per physician discretion, with treatment intervals ranging between 2 and 8 weeks, and follow-up visits occurred at 1 and 3 months after the last treatment. For the physician investigator grading, all subjects were graded as improved at both the 30 and 90-day follow-up. Blinded photographic review by 3 independent blinded physicians had a mean of 89.7% of cases selected correctly, with at least 2 of the 3 in agreement for 100% of the cases. Optical coherence tomography imaging showed significant reductions in vessel density and diameter of the superficial vascular plexus. No serious adverse events were noted. The authors highlight this laser proved efficacious and safe in a variety of vascular lesions with a high degree of improvement at the 90-day follow-up. They mentioned the advantage of having a large spot size available as well. Moreover, they highlight that optical coherence tomography imaging has emerged as a valuable tool for evaluating and managing vascular lesions, providing visualization of vascular depth, diameter, and density within the superficial vascular plexus.
I'm Curran Lal, and I will be reviewing TCA, also known as trichloroacetic acid, as an alternative method to manage hidradenitis suppurativa fistulas. TCA is a commonly used chemical used to treat many lesions and deep acne scars. This group treated 5 patients with Hurley stage 2 and 3 HS with recurrent small fistulas. They used 20% trichloroacetic acid in a 0.3 ml syringe and injected 0.1 ml per fistula in each tract. The sites were covered with silver sulfadiazine cream afterwards, and they followed the patients 1 week after. They report patients had tolerable pain for less than 1 minute and there were no recurrences. Topical or local anesthesia was not required for this procedure. This small case study supports the use of low-concentration trichloroacetic acid for chemical debridement and healing of HS fistulas without the need for local anesthesia or surgery. Though they had a small number of patients, they had healing noted at 1 week with no recurrence in these patients, some having 10 to 15 months of follow-up. I'm Curran Lal, and I will be reviewing treatment of cutaneous atrophy after corticosteroid injection with heterologous type 1 collagen. Intralesional corticosteroids are commonly employed in the dermatology setting for a number of inflammatory diseases. And because of this, atrophy is also something that we commonly see. It usually occurs 2 to 3 months after treatment and can persist for a long time, sometimes 5 years or plus in some cases. Treatment of this atrophy has been reported with saline, fat grafting, hyaluronic acid-based filler, and different laser energy-based devices. In this case study, they treated 2 patients with hypopigmentation and atrophy following orthopedic intralesional corticosteroid injections for decor veins, tennis synovitis, and tennis elbow. Patients were injected with 100 milligrams of linerase, which is type 1 collagen reconstituted in 5 cc's of normal saline. Patients had 4 treatments at 2 week intervals. The injections were done intradermally or subdermally. Both patients had clinical improvement with regards to atrophy, elasticity, translucency, hypopigmentation, and telangiectasias. One patient had complete resolution while the other had 90% improvement. No adverse events were noted. While the study is only a case series of 2 patients, steroid atrophy is very common and troublesome to manage in the clinical setting, as patients are often not happy with recurrent treatments that are done over a long period of time that often provide minimal improvement. I'm surprised, based on the images, figures 4-to-1 that I recommend you see with regards to the improvement in the pigmentation, because hypopigmentation is very hard to treat even after we manage the atrophy with usually normal saline. But authors report that histologic studies have noticed melanocytes are often noted and not completely erased in hypopigmented lesions from cutaneous corticosteroid atrophy.
This is Tara Jennings reviewing the communication adjuvant topical sirolimus for pulse dye laser in pediatric capillary malformation by first author Yaron Gol and senior author Deshaun Sebaratnam. As background, topical sirolimus with dosing ranging between 0.1 to 1% has been used as an adjunct with PDL for capillary malformations and has had very conflicting results in the literature with clearance rates ranging between 15 to 90%. The authors of the study conducted a retrospective review of 10 patients with capillary malformations who received PDL treatment with adjuvant topical sirolimus. 9 out of 10 patients had facial capillary malformations, and 1 patient had a lower extremity capillary malformation. The median age at first treatment was 4 months with a range of 1.5 weeks to 5 years, and Fitzpatrick phototypes ranged between 1 to 4. All patients received monotherapy with PDL for 1 to 2 sessions, followed by the addition of topical 0.1% sirolimus twice daily in subsequent sessions, scheduled every 4 to 6 weeks. Fluences were titrated according to phototype, anatomic location, and clinical response. There was no objective assessment for response to therapy, but authors reported that all patients demonstrated significant improvement in cosmesis, as determined by serial photography and the caretaker's feedback. Of note, burns occurred in 50% of patients, of whom 2 had persisting contour change. There are several serious limitations of this study, including small sample size, retrospective design, lack of objective assessment for cosmesis, and heterogeneous cohort and treatment regimens. Furthermore, it's concerning that 50% of patients experienced burns, with 2 out of 5 of those experiencing permanent effects from the burn. Authors state that the burns may have been secondary to the aggressive settings used in their group, but they fail to mention the settings used for the patients in this cohort. Furthermore, authors cite a paper from PEDSDERM in which ulceration occurred following PDL with adjunct 1% sirolimus, and subtherapeutic levels of sirolimus were detected in the serum. The percentage of burns in this paper, as well as the concerning case series from PEDSDERM and varied results in the literature, make me hesitant about this treatment regimen in my practice. Of course, prospective studies are needed to validate sirolimus's role as an adjunct in the treatment of capillary malformations.
This is Isabella Jones reviewing pyogenic granuloma following treatment of port wine stain with hemoporphyrin-mediated photodynamic therapy by Zha and Li. Hemoporphyrin-mediated PDT is a non-invasive technology that uses the photosensitizer hemoporphyrin in combination with light to generate excess reactive oxygen species to target and destroy vascular endothelial cells. The treatment has received China's FDA approval for port wine stains in 2017. The authors report three cases of pyogenic granulomas developing after this treatment when it was used for port wine stains. The article goes into further detail on each case. They review that pyogenic granulomas can form after trauma, pregnancy, or certain medications, but there are studies showing a potential link to somatic BRAF mutations. The authors also bring up a point that prior studies have challenged the designation of port wine stains as arteriovenous anastomoses or arteriovenous malformations. This is Isabella Jones reviewing The Challenge of Regrowing Hair with Lasers in Androgenetic Alopecia by Juhasz and Mesenskoza. In this split scalp study, five male patients with androgenetic alopecia were treated to one side of the scalp with eight passes of fractional 1550 nanometer laser at 10 to 12 millijoules every 2 weeks for six sessions. That side also received topical therapy. The other side was treated with just topicals without laser treatment. Two patients were instructed to apply topical 5% minoxidil during the study, and three of the patients topical 1% finasteride. The patients were followed with optical coherence tomography, photography, and patient-reported outcomes at baseline and then also at 6, 12, and 18 weeks after. The authors showed that compared to the side that was treated with topicals only, the side that was treated with laser and topical therapy did better. However, they observed that in the patients on minoxidil, once the laser treatment was stopped, the hair count sharply dropped. In the three patients on topical finasteride, the hair count remained stable after laser treatment was finished. So they believe that the finasteride, unlike minoxidil, may actually help stimulate terminal hairs. They also note that the cost associated with laser therapy would be a hindrance to patients continuing this, and patients with darker skin phototypes may not benefit as much due to needing to use lower densities to avoid post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation. They conclude that low-energy, high-density 1550 nanometer laser every 2 weeks in combination with 1% topical finasteride may be an effective therapy for patients with androgenetic alopecia of the frontal hairline.
This is Monica Bowen, and I'll be evaluating beard and body hair transplantation by follicular union excision using a skin-responsive device, a multicenter study by authors Kavi Shodin and Alejandro Gonzalez. Follicular union excision is favored for hair transplantation because it avoids linear scars and facilitates the utilization of non-scalp beard and body hair in patients who have extensive baldness. The problem with using non-scalp hair is that it has different characteristics than scalp hair, but it can be helpful in areas on the neck and other areas where these hairs can be more closely matched. So this was patient data from four multinational hair restoration clinics using follicular union excision, and the transplantation device was Dr. Eugraf Zeus. They assessed patient outcomes and demographics and ease of use. A total of 82 patients, mean age of 48.9, were evaluated. And they noticed that the overall loss of grafts for the beard and body was less than 7%, which is a marked improvement over previous methods. Most patients had class 1 donor scalps. And after 6 months, 79.1% of 43 patients rated their outcomes very happy, and 20.9% found it satisfactory. This is Monica Bowen, and I'll be evaluating how we do it: large volume breast tumescent autologous fat transfer
by author Paul Salmon from New Zealand. So this author specializes in large volume fat transfer to the breast. To do this, you need to do preoperative external expansion of the breast parenchymal compartment so that interstitial pressures can be kept low to avoid tamponade of vessels. And this is utilized by doing these negative pressure dressings that are shown in figure one. And this is required to be performed 4 to 12 weeks before the procedure. Afterwards, during the procedure, the donor sites of fat for the transfer are usually the thigh or abdomen, as they have low fibrous content. The harvesting of the breast fat is at low pressure to minimize emulsification and is delivered via 14 and 16 gauge cannulas. And there is a diagram showing how the fat is put into the breast. And they start at the subdermal space and they are fanned out through there. And subsequent passes are at deeper levels. Afterwards, the patients must use these vacuum dome to splint the breast post-operatively. And they encourage rest for about 3 weeks. Final result is stable by 3 months. However, a second procedure may be required to achieve the size or rejuvenation the patient desires.
This is Megan McLean reviewing the communication Hemorrhage of Varicose Veins, an Indication for Sclerotherapy, out of the Bern University Hospital in Bern, Switzerland. Venous hemorrhage in the lower extremities can be a severe complication of protruding varicose veins. The authors report a case of recurrent bleeding associated with a varicose pearl in a 75-year-old patient. He had had intermittent bleeding from this site for 7 years. Prior interventions had included crossectomy and stripping of the great saphenous veins and several phlebectomies. Ultrasound revealed an insufficient branch varicose vein leading to the site of the hemorrhagic crested nodule. He underwent ultrasound-guided sclerotherapy procedure, injecting 3 milliliters of polidocanol 0.5% foam mixed with air at a 1-to-4 ratio. Compression therapy was administered for 2 weeks. Follow-up after 3 months revealed complete healing of the hemorrhagic nodule. The report suggests sclerotherapy is a precise, minimally invasive, and safe approach for symptomatic or bleeding varicosities where surgery is not indicated or otherwise preferred by the patient.
This is Tara Jennings, and I will be reviewing the communication tips and tricks to avoid poor scarring and lip lifting. A technical note by first author Rafael Rousseau and senior author David DeChico. Lip lift surgery techniques have been modified to address noticeable scarring, enlargement of the alar base, and flattening of the nasolabial sill. The authors of this article provide a summary of these modified techniques to aid in optimal scarring after a surgical lip lift. The summarized surgical technique and key steps are as outlined. First, the readers are directed to the endonasal lip lift technique previously reported by this group for instructions on surgical marking. For help with this step, they recommend using Castro Viejo calipers to measure the distance between the lateral edges of the nasal ala. The authors then use an 11 blade to cut along the surgical marking, and the area is then bluntly dissected in the subcutaneous plane. The alar cinch stitch is the first key step performed. This stitch acts to counteract tensile forces that arise after the lip is anchored upward. This can lead to alar flaring and anatomical enlargement of the nasal base. The suture is performed by passing a 2-0 non-absorbable monofilament suture bilaterally through the fibroareolar tissue at the base of the nasal ala. The next key step consists of trimming the base of the triangular flaps if they exceed the recipient sites. Once trimmed, 1-3-0 non-absorbable transcutaneous suture is placed at the apex of each triangular flap. The third key step is the alar facial sulcus suture. This stitch aims to reduce the skin tension on the ala and facilitates a natural transition between the ala, the medial cheek, and the upper lip. This is performed by using a 3-0 absorbable multifilament full-thickness suture, which is passed from the nasal vestibule outwards to the lateral part of the incision on the ipsilateral side. The suture then engages the dermal layer of the caudal margin and the dermal layer of the nasal ala. It is directed backwards towards the nasal vestibule and then tied. I would like to direct readers to figure 1, which provides an artistic representation of these key steps. Lastly, authors note that this endonasal technique reduces scarring by placing the most tensile region in the nasal vestibule, as opposed to the typical bullhorn technique, in which tensions produced by the repositioning of the caudal flap cause scar enlargement in aesthetic areas. A photograph provided in the supplemental content highlights the difference in scarring between the two techniques. Overall, this was a nice summary of the key steps to reduce poor outcomes, and readers should be directed towards the author's original papers for further details on how to perform the procedure.
This is Megan McLean reviewing the communication Old is Gold, Outcome of Mini Punch Grafting Using Cyanoacrylate Glue in Female Genital Vitiligo by Ankita Pundir from BRD Medical College in India. The author highlights a paucity of reports in the literature of repigmentation results from punch grafting in female vulvar vitiligo. Genital vitiligo may be associated with sexual disorders, with women reported to have a higher prevalence of this than men. The author reports successful repigmentation of vulvar skin using miniature punch grafting and cyanoacrylate glue. The patient involved was a 22-year-old female with stable vitiligo of the vulva for 2.5 years. 2 millimeter punches from the anterolateral thigh were used as donor tissue. The patient underwent 2 procedures with 30 to 35 grafts in the first and 10 to 15 grafts in the second, both done under local anesthesia. A 26-gauge needle tip was used to carefully place cyanoacrylate glue at 4 equidistant points between the graft and the recipient tissue. Repigmentation was first noted on the 16th day after the first surgery and was completed by 2 months. The author notes that grafts in the posterior fourchette failed on both procedures, though elsewhere repigmentation was largely successful, as can be seen in Figure 1 and 2. More detail into the surgical procedure and post-op care can be found within the communication. The author states that this is the first publication to her knowledge demonstrating successful repigmentation of vulvar vitiligo after autologous mini punch grafting.
Thank you for listening to Derm Surgery Digest, the official podcast of the Dermatologic Surgery Journal. To access these featured articles, author videos, and much more, visit journals.lww.com/dermatologicsurgery. To learn more about the American Society for Dermatologic Surgery, visit asds.net.